It took almost 20 minutes, but finally the Sekhmen rounded up the few remaining stragglers of the rebel party that had attacked them. There were three survivors in all. The party of Sekhmen that had been dispatched into the fields as soon as the train stopped had eventually attacked them from the rear, culling them in swift order. The three survivors, still dressed in their dark clothes and wool caps, were made to kneel in the dirt close to the tower, and their hands were tied behind their backs. Adam, the commanding officer of the train crew, wearing his dark vest to better show the ghastly scarification running down his arms to match his misshapen, abused face, pulled the .44 Magnum from his hip holster once more and held it at the head of one of his prisoners.
Why did you attack the train?
Screw you, Outlander!
Look at me, not the ground! Look at me, brave man, and say that again!
Fuck you!
The next one won't be so lucky! The next one, I shoot in the gut and leave for the burrowers. Now, I want to know why you attacked my train.
You came here 9 months ago. You came in the night, and you stole our crops, and you took my only son, and not just him, other children of the field. For 8 months, we asked the same question. Why? Why did they take our sons and our daughters? Why?
9 months is long enough to produce another son. Think of the boy as your tribute to the Baron.
God damn you!
We answer to no one here. Hazel has always been a free vill.
A free vill? You hear that, men? A free vill is what Hazel is!
From her window, Christy felt her stomach drop as she watched the two Sekhmen approach the kneeling man where he struggled by the skeletal tower. These Sekhmen wore large, sturdy backpacks that glinted with a sheen of metal, and they each held a long pipe in their hands. The pipes were attached to their backpacks with a short length of hose. The Sekhmen stood 8 feet from their kneeling victim, 3 or 4 paces between them, and leveled the pipe nozzles. Christy turned away, but she could see the man's fate in her mind's eye. Watching from her position under the train, Mildred heard the familiar sound of the engine warming up.
All aboard!
Mildred hoped that the Sekhmen just in front of her might jump onto the train. He just stood there, his dirt-streaked boots directly in front of her. She felt the thrum of movement on the tracks where she rested as the train began to pull slowly away, and watched as the wheels began to gradually roll. She pulled herself tighter under the train between the tracks, watching the wheels pass her. The length of the car above her was 18 feet. She had that long to come up with a way to roll out from under its moving body, kill the Sekhmen, and get back onto the train. Not necessarily in that order. She hugged Ryan's gun closer to her body as the train chugged along the tracks, gathering speed. Mildred reminded herself that the speed of the train was negligible just now, barely 3 or 4 miles per hour. She looked toward the rear of the train as it began to pick up speed. The clearance above her was about 15 inches, and she could see that at least one of the ramshackle units rested lower to the ground than that. She pushed her chest and the side of her face to the shingle between the tracks, clutching the weapon to her side as the train trudged over her. She shifted her head uncomfortably to the left, watching as a thin gap between the cars approached. The next car would follow, the storage unit with the windshield walls that she had walked through less than 12 hours before. Its bed fell lower, and there were thin, spiky shafts hanging below where the pipework of the structure had been rudely finished. The struts were pencil thin and various lengths, one almost reaching to the ground, and each was marked with the grime it had picked up on the journey. As the sliver of light between the cars passed overhead, Mildred closed her eyes, pressing her nose down into the pebbly surface between the rungs of the tracks. She felt the spikes drag across her back and shoulders, snagging runs of her skin and wrenching them painfully away. Farther down her body, she felt a tug at the seat of her combat pants, and she pressed herself harder into the ground, willing the ordeal to be over. She felt something tangle in her hair, and the skin of her scalp burned as something pulled at it until a braid of her plaited hair was yanked from her head. The dark, oil-smeared wheels passed just 2 inches from her face, and then came the gap between them, Aunt Mildred saw the dark shape of the sec man lying there, his mouth wide open, his eyes blank in death.
Come on, my dear doctor! You have a patient to treat!
Mildred looked farther to her left, where the voice had called from. She could see Doc's sword stick hanging in the space between the cars, and she ducked down beneath it as it passed overhead. She timed the movement of the passing wheels on the next car, saw the gap between the large sets of wheels, and scrambled out from beneath the train, still holding Ryan Steyer. From the gap between the car ahead of her, Mildred saw Doc's smiling face poking out, and he beckoned to her with his hand as he stood on the lip of the door.
Quickly now!
Mildred darted forward and grabbed his outstretched arm, using it to pull herself up between the cars beside him.
Thanks, Doc.
Mildred and Doc were back in the compartment with Christy, though now it was Mildred who sat in the bed while Christy tended to her wounds, dabbing them with a piece of rag doused in the antiseptic mouthwash that Mildred had picked up for her med kit somewhere on her travels. It wasn't the antiseptic she would have chosen, and it stung like hell when Christy applied it to the abrasions on her face. But Mildred knew she needed to clean the wounds, and the small alcoholic content of the mouthwash would do that just as well as anything marketed for the job.
I've been trying to place where I've seen those towers before. It was there all along in the back of my mind. Doc, you spent some time in the 20th century, didn't you?
Some, but alackaday, it is sometimes a very blurred period in my memory.
Did you ever see one of those old RKO movies? An RKO radio picture? Do you remember that?
Doc shook his head slowly, a weary apology on his face.
There was a tower, just like the ones we've seen out there. A radio broadcast tower that spanned half the globe. An illustration showing how the RKO company was able to send their information through the airwaves.
Perhaps I saw something of its ilk. It strikes a vague chord with me, to be sure.
This tower stood proud over the world, and little bolts of lightning or something, the signal, I guess, zapped off its highest point.
This Arco used to flash lightning bolts over the world in the days before Megacall?
No, it was an illustration, an animated way of bringing the idea of broadcast to life.
Like a radio.
I think that those towers out there are radio transmitters.
But there is no wiring, nothing visible at least.
The wires are underground. That thing we saw, the big metal plate that opens into the lower part beneath the broadcast tower, that's where the workings are.
And what are they transmitting? Classic show tunes? Or perhaps they are sending telegrams to each other?
Except, I don't think it's a radio. That liquid they were using to fuel the cells, that was something organic. I'd swear it was. It had the sort of consistency you don't get in refined materials.
What does the fuel matter?
I think it's the fuel that's making you ill.
Well, if that is true, then why doesn't being aboard the train seem to have any direct effect on Christy? The fuel is stored here, after all. I saw them remove it from one of the forward cabins.
Proximity and pulse.
Meaning?
Pre-dark, we had mobile phones. A cell phone signal is not one continuous stream. It broadcasts in waves. If you put a cell phone beside a radio, you can hear the pulse affecting the reception. Crackle, crackle, clear signal, crackle, crackle, clear signal again. Now, like anything automated, that pulse would work to a set rhythm. What if our towers out there are doing the same thing, working to a set rhythm?
But if this signal is what is affecting Christie's fluctuating health, would not we have noticed the pattern of the broadcasts?
Proximity.
We've been traveling all over North Dakota at varying distances from the towers. If they are broadcasting in waves, in pulses, and we have varied our distance from them, then the pattern would be almost impossible to recognize without studying all of the factors and amassing a significant amount of empirical data. Perhaps with study and a map of the tower's locations, am I right?
Am I right? That's the $64,000 question.
Humblebee and several of the other children tried to copy the trick that the ghost boy Jack had shown them. He had produced a pocket knife, its blade gleaming in the indifferent light from the open door, and let the children carefully handle it, proving that it was as solid and real as they were. Then, with a flurry of his hands, the white-skinned youth had somehow made the knife disappear, apparently into thin air. Then Jack had used the pocket knife to carve away two small rigid strips from the wooden walls of the car and pass them to the children, under Maddie's silent sufferance. The wood strips were roughly the size and shape of his knife. The knife trick had been more than entertainment. Jack had wanted to get the children used to carrying shivs, working them in their hands. He wanted them armed, however crudely, for when he broke them free from the cage. As the children practiced with the wooden spikes, Jack went back to his own task, working away at the tight screws that held the hinges to the cage door. The screws were embedded deeply into the metal, but Jack had worked the thin point of a knife into the circular holding and slowly twisted. The knife had slipped numerous times, unable to hold in place against the tight screw, but Jack had silently endured, replaying the process until he finally got the right angle to use a torque action to loosen the fastener. He gradually rotated the knife by the leather-bound handle, careful not to lose the grip he'd found on the screw, and slowly, the head of the screw pulled away from its grounding. Satisfied with his progress, Jack left the screw in place and began the process on the second screw in the hinge. There were four screws in each hinge, eight in total, and he intended to loosen them all. It had been hours since he had eaten. The spiced ribs in Fairburn were almost 18 hours in the past now. He would survive for a while, but without food, he would become weak for the final assault.
When do you eat?
Maddie shrugged, a resigned smile on her face.
When they remember to feed us, I think.
Often?
Can be. Other times it will be almost a day. But sometimes we get two or three dishes. Good food, even, if it's a nice man.
None of them are nice. You remember that and you stay alive.
I'm sorry, Jack. I'll remember.
Don't be sorry. Be alive. Best type Maddie ever is.
Maddie! Maddie, look!
Maddie looked up, seeing that Mark had one of the wooden shards.
Look what Mark did!
Maddie watched, her face impassive, as Mark palmed the wooden shank, just as Jack had shown them.
Good. Show the others.
If I can remember.
Ryan and JB continued to make their hurried way through the train. The cars were busier now, as they got ever closer to the engine that drove the beast. There were more Sekmen, the small construction team they had seen at the towers, and at one point they passed the three white coats in the tight corridor of another bunk room, heading in the opposite direction. They passed through another double mess hall, busy with hungry Sekmen, who watched the gyrations of a dancing Jolt-High slut as they ate. There were two more rooms of food, similar to the one where JB had found the pineapple chunks, though the side of the foremost one had been damaged. The right-hand wall was peppered with holes like buckshot, and JB and Ryan took a closer look. The armorer poked his index finger through a hole, feeling the rush of air outside with the train's rapid passage across the Dakotan fields.
Took a hit from a homemade shotgun.
No. Look at the way the wounds wept. This is acid. Probably from a toxic rainstorm.
Avoided most of the shelling, but I guess this part of the state couldn't escape everything.
Since they had left the redoubt in Minot, North Dakota had proved to be a changeable mishmash of territory. The bland desert around Fairburn had given way rapidly to greener areas, and so to farmland that produced the richness of foods that had been sold in the walled ville. Fairburn had seemed isolated, but it was perhaps 15 miles from farmland. But that patch of rich, fertile land had proved brief. And as they had crossed the lake, they had seen evidence of poisoned terrain, destroyed by toxins in the air. Here, far to the south of the old territory, they saw the rank devastation of radiation. The land that the train traveled over was bare and pitted. No plants or greenery of any sort existed, not even moss or lichen. The soil was burned a dark shade of brown, almost black in fact, looking more like charcoal than earth. Large cracks crisscrossed the land, digging deep into the lifeless soil, like scars on a man's flesh. The ground here was sloped, evidence of earth flow, and the train traveled at a lurched angle, its port side noticeably lower than starboard for almost 3 miles. The tracks followed a perfectly straight line for the duration of the slope. Any curves would have likely derailed the train. As the ground began to level out once again, Ryan and JB heard the sound of the brakes being applied. They spotted another scaffold tower in the distance, from the window of the third crew bunk car in succession. They were 41 cars from the back of the train, closing on Jack's position fast. With no warning, Christy fell to the floor, stretching her hands up before her to cushion her fall.
Are you all right? Christy! Christy!
I'm fine.
The pain had started again, appearing from nowhere, an axe wound to her skull. Her muscles ached with cramp, her arms and legs heavy, and her heart was pounding in her chest as though thumping at her ribs to break free. Mildred and Doc helped lift her from the floor, pulling her across to the bunk and stretching her out there. Mildred placed her hand gently on Christie's forehead.
She's burning up.
This is madness. Sheer madness. She was fine, absolutely fine, not 10 seconds ago. It is impossible.
It's happening. So it can't be impossible. Whatever it is, it's happening again.
Mildred watched in horror as blood began streaming from her nose and around her gum line.
Only worse.
We are coming up on a tower.
You think the theory stands?
Though hardly the proof we wanted. I would say that this is, at the very least, a good signifier of our perceived correlation, would not you?
Hell yeah.
Adam had hopped back onto the train at the rearmost mess hall car when they had pulled away from the Hazel Tower. He had sat alone, consuming a late breakfast as the train trudged on to its next inevitable stop. He knew the route so well now, having traveled with the train on every one of its bi-monthly journeys, and he had grown to hate this section of the route. The burned ground south of Jamestown, where the fallout from the nukes had stretched its withering hand. It was a hot zone, the air itself still poisonous, even after a century of supposed recovery, and he could feel the poisons burying themselves into the scars that crossed his arms and face, eating into the muscles and tendons. So he chose to eat on this section of the loop on every go-round, so that he never need see the awful, barren landscape. Adam had been with the train crew from the very start, when Baron Burgess had assembled his team and proposed the project. Just another Sekhman in Burgess's army, Adam had climbed the ranks in the subsequent 4 years and now held the position of commanding officer, Burgess's trusted right-hand man. The Baron couldn't travel with the train any longer, though he had been with it in the early days as the monstrosity had shuddered along the tracks, placing towers and creating new rail routes where they were required. The old white coat at his side. These days, Baron Burgess couldn't leave his citadel. Like many of his men, Burgess had had to make sacrifices for the grand project, and the worst of them had been his own mobility. And so, Adam had taken the position of train commander. While the train was traveling, Adam was a demi-baron, and these people were his to command. After he had eaten, he got up and made his way toward the engine. They would be stopping at the next tower shortly, and he knew from experience that without a supervisor, the crew was likely to forget something. Messing up things was not an option any longer. The project was at final stage. They could no longer afford mistakes. He had asked both the Whitecoats and the Baron himself how the project fared, and they had all made agreeable noises. The tests had transpired and proved very encouraging. Adam had made his way through the cars, passing the store car and the curtained car of the Bruja. Adam did not approve of carrying the witch aboard, but Baron Burgess had felt she provided a service they could not get in any other manner. Adam was uncomfortable around the Bruja. He disliked the old woman, and he respected her mystical abilities, the way one might respect a dog with sharp teeth, fear and distrust. After 3 more cars stocked full of foodstuffs, Adam felt the familiar thrum through the soles of his boots as the driver pumped the brakes. They would be stopping at the tower in a couple of minutes. He stepped into the ordnance car and stopped, looking around him. The metal-sided car appeared empty.
Hey! Hey!
There was no one here. No guards. This was a weapons car, and he had posted guards. His men weren't known for disobeying his orders. He was the Baron as far as they were concerned. None of them had even expressed the slightest hint of mutiny, so there should be 2 Sekhmen here keeping watch, checking orders whenever anyone requisitioned a weapon. He stepped farther into the car, looking back and forth, a growing sense of unease welling within him.
Where are the fucking guards?
At the low counter, he found the giant Phil Billion, who appeared at first to be sleeping on the job.
Wake up, you worthless half-wit!
Adam bent closer, looking at the reclining body, spotting the dried stain on the metal floor beneath his face and his neck. Crouching, Adam prodded his ring finger into the dark stain, feeling the liquid that pooled there. The blood had congealed. It was almost dried now, and had taken on the dirt brown color of old blood. There was a wound in Phil's neck, a small hole piercing the cartilage of his trachea, maybe an inch across.
You got aced, you lazy simp.
Jen worked here too, always the shift with Phil. He had drawn up that rotation. The two always asked to work together.
Jen! Jen, you here? You hid, girl? You hid yourself?
Adam walked in a semi-crouch, heading for the front of the car, checking carefully between the shelving units for Jen or intruders. When he reached the far end, he stood by the door to the next car. He turned, looking back down the length of the car he had just walked, seeing Phil's corpse lying there in its own blood. He couldn't see Jen, couldn't see anyone else. Holding his gun in one hand, Adam lowered himself, bending at the knees to drop to the floor. Someone could hide under one of these shelving units, some thin bastard come to kill his men. He lowered his head, stretching his body flat to the floor, the Magnum close to his face, tracking the floor with eyes and weapon in unison. There was no one under there. The car was empty, bar himself and the corpse. Then, at the very last moment, he saw the hand hidden in the shadows beneath a shelving unit immediately beside him. There was a tiny tattoo of a rose, its petals proudly flowering in a burst of red, within the jumble of greens and blues that covered the hand.
Jen.
Adam pulled the woman's corpse out by the arm, bringing her from beneath the shelving unit, until he saw the puncture in her forehead where the bullet had gone straight through her brain. Then Adam stood and made his way to the horizontal cord that ran high along the left-hand edge of every car. He sounded the alert. They had intruders. Jack had loosened five of the screws that held the gate's hinges to the frame of the cage. He was working at the sixth when Humblebee rushed over to him.
There's a man coming.
Jack pulled his knife from the groove of the sixth screw and palmed the blade as a sec man trudged in from the rear of the car, shuffling sideways along the narrow route that ran by the side of the cage. Jack remained cross-legged by the cage door and watched the sec man from the corner of his eye. The sec man had a curly mop of dark hair, long sideburns, and the signs of several days' beard darkening his chin. He carried a large rifle held on a strap that rested on his left shoulder, crosswise over his body, hanging below the level of his groin. As he stepped in front of Jack, the albino flicked his wrist. The movement pushed his leaf-bladed knife from its hiding place in his hand, down his sleeve, the sec man none the wiser.
What you doing there, Whitey? I asked you a question, boy. You a simp as well as a snow-skinned freak?
Jack continued to look at the sec man, his glaring eyes locked.
Did you bring us any food?
The man looked up at Maddie.
Brats want to eat. And what you gonna do for it? How you gonna earn your dinner? What? You gonna sing for it? Put on a striptease, maybe. Little piece like you.
Leave her alone! She's just hungry. We're all hungry.
We got a fucking intruder!
The sec man turned, looking through the open doorway. Men were walking around outside. Jack could see them busying themselves as they patrolled the area around the stalled train. Guns at the ready.
I'll be back for you, sweet meat.
JB had speculated that the triple burst of bells was some kind of warning system, and Ryan agreed, feeling deep in his gut, that they had been discovered. The companions continued along the train, keeping their heads low as they walked through two more cars stocked with repair equipment and demolition explosives. JB paused at the demolition material, picking up a few items and judging their weight and flexibility. Old-fashioned dynamite stood there in sticks like thick candles, but there was also some combustible liquids, some accelerant, and a small slab of Plasex. There were two more cars full of food stock, a few old mill rations sitting side by side with cured meats and preserves. The train began moving again as they entered the next car. They had walked into a wooden box featuring a ladder that led up to a raised portion of ceiling in the middle of the room. Built into the roof, an ex-military railgun had been mounted on a swiveling pedestal, and a gunner sat there, scanning the landscape with a pair of binoculars. The sides of the car featured arrow slits, holes big enough to shoot from while still keeping the occupants well protected. There were five secmen in the car, including the upside gunner, and they were all on high alert. As Ryan and JB stepped through the door, they found themselves facing a selection of gun barrels.
Easy, brother, easy.
He one of them?
Don't recognize either of them.
JB kept his hands held loosely at his sides as he stood behind Ryan, feeling the folds of his coat sway around him.
What's going on?
You heard the alarm. Adam says there's intruders on the train. Found two dead in the ordnance car.
That's too bad. Who was it?
Ryan tried to remember the name that the woman had shouted.
Phil? They get Phil?
Yep. I heard it was Phil and his missus.
Ah, Phil. You hear that, JB?
Didn't he owe you some jack?
He had only two left to pay. That ain't right.
It was code, and JB hoped that Ryan would pick up on it. JB could take the two on the left, but he didn't have a clear shot for the others. Ryan would need to deal with them.
I got some. I can cover your debts. Think I could make things right.
You fellas knew Phil? I don't remember you. You got names?
Ryan and John. We were with one of the construction crews. Jumped on last night, just outside Fairburn.
Is that...
Now!
JB's hand was already beneath his coat, pulling up the mini Uzi. He wasted the 2 second man to his left. The second man on the right leapt aside as Ryan reeled off shot after shot at him. The man at the overhead railgun peeked down the ladder, a silver-plated .38 shining in his hand. He ducked back into his cubbyhole. Ryan and JB scurried to the right, out of their attacker's potential arc of fire. Ryan watched him through the rungs of the ladder, while JB trained his Uzi at the top of the ladder, ready for the overhead gunner. Suddenly, the train lurched around a sharp bend in the track, and all three of the men on the ground level staggered, losing their positions. The sec man behind the ladder recovered, aiming his gun at JB. JB quickly raised his Uzi, tracking the man who had just fired at him. Ryan looked at JB, seeing the flash of pain that crossed his face, and a single eye moved down to the armorer's gut, where the bullet had hit. A dark stain was forming on his shirt. The armorer looked down as he regained his composure, pulled back one side of his jacket, reached into an interior pocket, and pulled out the can of pineapple chunks. There was a dent in the can, and syrupy liquid was trickling from the far side, creating the stain. The two companions walked carefully forward, edging around the area beneath the circular hole in the roof. Across the other side of the ladder, JB gestured to Ryan, miming the pumping of a shotgun barrel and making a querulous face. JB was right. The man could have a whole stack of weapons up there besides the .38. It wouldn't do to just rush up there while he appeared to be reloading. JB took careful aim with the Uzi and fired up the ladder and into the cavity above. Ryan edged closer to the ladder, silently instructing JB to fire again. One of the bullets had hit the sec man, maybe off a ricochet. Ryan reached up, the Sig Sauer steady in his grip, and pushed the nose of the gun against the car's wooden roof. He pulled the blaster away as three thin streams of red began to drip through the bullet holes in the ceiling. Without looking back, Ryan and JB reloaded their weapons and continued. Mildred had held Christy's head, pulling her hair back while the woman spluttered blood into the washbowl that Doc had passed her. After a while, Christy had turned to spluttering pink drools of saliva, dry heaving but producing nothing else from her stomach. Her whole body shook, and she had cried pitifully with the explosive force of her vomiting. But it had finally passed, and she now lay back on the bunk, her eyes closed as Mildred and Doc watched over her. The vomiting spell had lasted almost 15 minutes, pretty much the whole time that the train remained stationary at the tower in the wastelands.
Curse those blasted towers.
Doc, there's nothing we can do but keep her safe.
I hate to see her hurting like this.
It hurts us all, Doc.
Ryan should be here now.
This whole situation has been impossible since the second we got here. We're stretched thin, vulnerable, and Christy's...
Christy's what?
Christy's in a lot of trouble.
Ryan and JB found themselves in a cold, unlit car that stank of human waste. To their right was a cage, and inside were six children, along with the corpse of a seventh. The children huddled together under a sack that had been split to make a blanket, remaining as far from the rotting corpse as they were able in the tight confines of the cage. Ryan and JB were both relieved and disappointed to find that Jack was not among them. JB stood with his Uzi ready, watching through the open slit of the car as the tortured landscape hurtled past. The children ignored both men, clearly used to armed adults intruding on their tiny world, assuming them to be part of the force of their captors.
We should free them.
JB nodded a definite yes as he thought through the angles of such an operation.
Need to have somewhere to put them, away off the train, a way to keep the crew off our backs and theirs.
JB pointed to the horizontal slit that ran the length of the car, gesturing to the dead landscape outside the train.
It's red hot out there. No place to take children.
Hey!
Ryan offered the children a friendly smile as he came up to the cage.
I need you to help me.
None of the children reacted. They just watched him blankly, their eyes wide in fear.
I'm looking for a friend of mine, a man with white skin. Anyone seen him?
The children continued to look at Ryan, remaining absolutely still and silent. JB reached across, skimming Ryan's arm with his knuckles.
They're scared, Ryan. They're terrified.
I know. We're friends. We'll get you out. We'll come back and we'll get you out. I promise.
Then Ryan and JB departed, stepping through the door into the next car. They saw the remains of a cage, parts of the grillwork still dangling from the hold roof. There was blood and body parts all over the car, and a gaping hole in the exterior walls on either side bore witness to where the rocket had passed straight through. The body parts were small, the little legs and arms of children. One of the bodies was almost intact, just missing a hand, but it was charred, black where the flesh had burned in the ensuing fire after the rocket had hit. JB stooped and prodded at some body parts with the muzzle of his Uzi.
Find something?
No one I recognize.
JB rose from his sifting on the floor, his expression equal parts weariness, anger, and determination.
Jack's a survivor. He'll be right as rain.
They walked through the ashes that covered the floor and opened the door into the next car.
Men coming!
Jack palmed the knife in his hand and rolled back from the cage door. Mark was holding one of the makeshift daggers that Jack had carved from the wall, and he copied the albino's move as best he could, palming the weapon in a half second. The rear door opened, and two men walked in, guns in their hands. The one in the lead had to crab walk through the narrow corridor alongside the cage, just as Jack had imagined.
Ryan and JB.
Jack stood and walked with them as they both rounded the cage to stand in the larger gap in front of the bolted door.
Dark Knight, it's good to see you.
How they been treating you?
Jack pulled open the top few buttons of his dark shirt, showing Ryan the purple bruise that had been generated when he'd been hit with a trank dart.
Dot gun. See you again. I chill to shoot her. Christy, she better yet?
Hard to say, Jack. She's been out of it half the time. Mildred was none the wiser when we left them. They're both on the train with us, along with Doc, keeping a low profile in a secure cabin.
Surprised to see you in here. Thought you'd have come up with six escape routes by the time we caught up with you.
Shit. I got seven. Just deciding when.
That's my boy.
Jack felt a presence at his side and turned to see that Maddie was standing there, holding Humblebee's little hand in her own, with Mark and Allison just behind. They were all looking at Ryan and JB.
Let me introduce fans. Ryan and JB. 100% loyal.
Humblebee pointed to Ryan's face.
What happened to your eye?
I had a fight with my brother a long time ago, and it ended up that he took my eye out.
Did you chill him?
Had to in the end.
Just then, the door at the front of the car opened, and the curly-haired sec man burst in.
I'm ready for you, little dance, sweetheart!
The man stopped in mid-stride, looking at the two armed strangers in shock. Adam had called together his troops when the train had halted at the tower in the poisonous wastelands. When he explained the situation to the dozen men, one of them had piped up with an interesting point. The man's name was Boren, a sour-tempered individual with a hook in place of his left hand, but still a dead aim with his right.
Anyone seen anything of Sean Gibbons? He was rear guard and I was meant to relieve him this morning. But when I got there, there weren't no sign of him.
Gibbons? Why didn't you bring this to me earlier?
I didn't think it meant anything. Maybe he just slipped and fell off. What do I know?
Yeah, could have been. We've lost men before, I'll accept that. You weren't to know better.
So, what do we do now?
Get the word out. We gotta some intruders aboard. Maybe one, maybe more. You see anyone you don't recognize and you challenge them. Bring them to me if you think it's necessary. We're a big crew, I know, and there's maybe people on side you don't know. Use your brains. Stay alert. Don't chill one of our own.
This is mayhem. Anarchy. We go around challenging everybody? What about the project, man? What about that?
I'll make sure the project stays on target. You just let me worry about that.
Ray had known the second he entered the prison car, before he'd even seen the two men who stood there. It was the change in atmosphere. The heavy taint of fear wasn't there any longer. There was a man standing at the door to the cage. He was tall and powerfully built, with the sure stance of an arena fighter. His unruly dark hair was long and curly, and he held a gun. Ray looked across to see the second stranger. He couldn't claim to know every person on the train, as he'd only been with the operation for 2 months. This was only his second go-round the loop, but he was sure he had never seen these two before.
Well, fuck me sideways and call me Daisy!
Ray pulled the door back toward him, leaping backward and slamming it shut. He rushed through the next car, another cage unit full of stinking, filthy brats, a narrow walkway along the left side. He heard the door open again behind him. Ray dashed ahead, reaching for the wooden door at the front of the car. He dived through the door and into the next car, just as the man lifted his Uzi.
Damn, missed!
JB followed the sec man into the next car. The man had stumbled as he ran down the narrow corridor beside the cage, but by the time JB was clear of the door, he had stumbled through the next door of the train.
We got a live one, Ryan!
Together, Ryan and JB ran through the car and reached for the exit door into the next unit. JB went through the door first. Ryan dived through the door behind JB, and they found themselves in another storage unit, half empty but stocked with food. The dark-haired sec man was scrambling through the tight corridor between the wooden shelves. Ryan and JB weaved between the half-empty shelves, using them as cover. At the far end of the car, the sec man had reached the next door.
We do not need this.
Agreed. Let's shut the runner up and get back to Jack.
They ran between the shelves, and Ryan took the lead as they prepared to enter the next car. With JB standing across from him, Ryan's hand reached out to turn the handle of the door. Ryan dived backward, spinning as he dropped to the floor. JB leapt back as well, slamming himself into the wall behind him. Ryan brought up the Sig Sauer to cover the door as it caved inward under the force of a mighty kick. Ryan aimed blindly into the open doorway.
How many of them?
JB was skirting along the sidewall, skipping backward on light feet as he moved away from the open door.
Not sure, but it's more than just a runner.
Fire blast. What is it, old witch?
Adam stood in front of the brouhaha in the incense-thick car, a dark kerchief over the lower half of his face. The brouhaha's head rose heavily, her dim eyes ineffectually piercing the gloomy car, to see the commanding officer standing there, 3 paces from her table. He was so close that she might reach out and grab him, she realized, and a thin smile crossed her lips.
Speak! Is it the project?
The project, yes.
But there's more. Speak, old witch. I won't ask you over and over.
He looked away from the brouhaha to see the alarm had been tripped.
Later.
Another.
But Adam had already left and was jogging along the train's length. The brouhaha closed her ancient roomy eyes and concentrated on the pain that was emanating from the other. The woman who, like her, could feel the stab of the broadcast. Ryan and JB weaved through the food storage car as a rain of bullets split the air. Behind them, 3 sec men had rushed through the door from the far car, including the curly-haired man with the homemade blaster. JB ducked down behind a wooden shelving unit.
Shit! Oh, fuck me!
The sec men took cover as the bullets rent the air. Through the smoking hole of the open doorway, JB saw more figures approaching.
Come on!
JB leapt through the open door and sped down the narrow corridor by the side of the cage full of children, with Ryan at his heels, heading for the car where Jack and the other children waited. Jack watched as the door burst open and Ryan and JB came hurtling through.
We got a wagload of trouble following us. Keep the kids down or they're liable to get shot.
Need help?
Whatever you can do.
Door come off if I push it. Pin off of the screws.
Good work. Choose your moment wisely. You probably won't get a second chance now.
With that, Ryan and JB disappeared into the next car. Moments later, 8 sec men filed through the car. One of the rearmost sec men was the curly-haired one who had taunted Maddie, and Jack slipped his knife from his sleeve as the man followed his colleagues along the narrow corridor and into the next car. A moment later, a 9th sec man, a straggler with blood on his shirt by his left shoulder, staggered into the car, accompanied by a 10th man holding a Smith & Wesson revolver low to his body. Jack stood near the back of the cage, watching these men enter, and he hunkered low into himself, the knife hidden in his hand. As the man with the wounded shoulder stepped in front of the cage, Jack ran at the door. He jumped off the floor, slamming high into the hinged side with shoulder and hip simultaneously. The cage door toppled into the wounded sec man, the top of the door hitting his forehead. Jack was already using his momentum to push him into the second man, the one brandishing the revolver. And he plunged the knife in his right hand into the man's body, just beneath his sternum.
Shit! That was easy.
They were in the shattered car that had been rent open by the rocket attack. Ryan was already at the far end, pulling open the sliding door. JB ran through the ash and charred bodies of the dead children, ducking the broken remains of the cage. Sekman charged through the door. As he ran, JB's heel slipped in the ash on the floor, and suddenly he felt himself skidding forward, overbalanced and falling to his left. A rush of air slammed into his face as he stumbled through the gaping hole that had been left in the rocket's wake. And suddenly he was falling through space with nothing beneath his feet.
JB, no!
Ryan watched in horror as JB slid and disappeared from view. There was no time to do anything to save his friend. The primary mission now was to keep himself alive, and Ryan knew it. He dived through the open door behind him and rolled across the floor of the next car. He reached back and slammed the door shut. Ryan looked up into the faces of six startled and very frightened children. Jack launched himself into the room filled with Sekmen. The other Sekmen were already gone. But Jack had wounded three in less than 5 seconds, and a fourth had stopped and spun to face him. Jack raised the revolver again.
Oh, boo-hoo! Out of bullets, Whitey.
Out of bullets? Still gonna kill you.
JB tumbled across the cracked, poisoned soil of the irradiated terrain beside the rushing behemoth of chrome and steel. He looked across to his right, his head held low, and watched as the train rushed along beside him. He pulled himself up and looked back down the tracks, considering how long he might have until the train was gone completely. There was a chance he could get back on. Just grab one of the side ladders, the same way he and Ryan and Mildred had originally boarded this monstrosity. That window was finite, and he would need to move swiftly. He looked around the cracked terrain at his feet until he spotted his compact Uzi, caked with filth, and next to it, his battered fedora.
One day I'm gonna lose one of these things and the whole fucking world is gonna end.
Still unsteady on his feet, JB stepped across to them and plucked the weapon and hat from the ground before turning back to face the train. The bloated cars had passed, and he had perhaps 15 more cars until the last unit went by. He looked up, spotting three rooftop gunners. Raising the Uzi, he took aim at the nearest gunner. There was still a roofman on the final car, but JB sprinted into the shadow cast by the train, he running in one direction as the train journeyed in the other, and trusted it was cover enough. The ladder sped toward him, and JB grabbed it as it passed, his feet scrabbling at the side of the train the second he had hold of it. His right arm burned in its socket, but his grip held. He hung there, calming his racing thoughts as the spoiled terrain raced past. His slip had left Ryan alone at the front of the train, facing more than a half dozen armed Sekmen who were all out for blood. And there wasn't a damn thing JB could do about it. It took Ryan a moment to realize that he wasn't alone in this firefight. Only three men had followed him through the door into the car with the second level, where he and JB had slaughtered the guards. He had rushed through the last car with the children in it, determined not to let them get hurt any more than they already had been. But he knew that at least six men had been chasing him when he had entered the last cage car, and yet there were only three now. He found a sheltered cranny by one of the arrow slits and used the Sig Sauer to keep his attackers at bay. Ryan's head flitted out from cover for a split second as he sized up the enemy. Three Sekmen, one armed with a shotgun, the others with automatic weapons.
There's nowhere left to run, son! You gotta know that!
Who says I'm gonna run?
You put down your weapon and we'll let you live! You hear me, boy? We let you live! You killed a couple of my guys here. I can't offer you any better than that.
Ryan swung out from his hiding place and fired in the direction of the voice. Next to him, the Sekmen with a shotgun brought it to bear on Ryan. At the same second, the door behind the Sekmen slid open, and Ryan saw Jack's pure white arm reach through in a swift flip, as though pitching a baseball. Ryan quickly honed in on the last Sekmen. Jack dashed into the car, looking left and right to check for further enemies, but finding none, he was followed by the group of filthy-looking children that he had been caged with.
Thanks, Jack. That's one I owe you.
Shit. You came to my rescue. We about even. Where now?
Back to Christy and the others. Get everyone together and see if we can find JB.
Say what?
JB avoided getting his brain splattered all over one of the cars by falling through a hole in the wall. Kept him alive, but not the choicest option.
Alive's alive.
There is that. And I suspect JB would agree with you.
They turned toward the rear door, leading the way into the next car with the children behind them. Ryan had taken two steps into the food store when he felt the cold metal of a gun barrel crack into the back of his skull. Jack saw Ryan fall in the poorly lit room before him, and he made to turn, ushering the children back. As he turned, he found himself facing the end of a .44 Magnum, similar to his own missing weapon. Adam, the commanding officer on the train, smiled.
Your move, white skin.
The first thing that Ryan felt when he awoke was the rushing wind slapping into his face and the burning pain in his limbs. Warily, he opened his good eye. Two parallel steel lines stretched off into the distance, and to either side he saw the forbidding landscape of the scarred and poisoned earth. Above, the sky was dark with fierce, toxin-heavy clouds, and Ryan could see the land rushing past him. He had been bowsprited, tied to the carved figurehead of the muti bitch with a bare breasts and snake's tail that stretched out in front of the massive engine of the train. Beneath him, the steel tracks glinted in the afternoon sunlight, just 2 feet below his hanging body. The pressure on his arms was almost intolerable. Ropes had been tied around his wrists and ankles, securing him to the figurehead at a 45-degree angle, his head thrust forward and the full weight of his body dangling from those ties. The coarse fibers of the ropes chafed at him, but already his limbs were falling into a blessed numbness, all sensation leaving them. And so he hung there, buffeted by the wind, as the mighty engine dragged the train across the cancerous terrain, dust and bugs peppering his naked face, as they were caught up in the draft created by the train's passing. Jack had been forced to watch as Adam's men hoisted Ryan's body up and tied it to the figurehead at the very front of the train. Jack's own hands had been bound using a leather belt, and there were 15 SEC men, including Adam, standing nearby, each of them armed and wary of the lethal albino.
One Eye here will be hung there till he dies of thirst or starvation, a warning to anyone who disobeys the Baron's will. What do you think of that, Whitey? What? Cat got your tongue? You ain't a mute, I know that, boy.
That was it. That was the key, Jack realized. Boy, the horrifically scarred commanding officer of the train had called him boy. Like the trick with the knife that he had shown the children, Jack knew that people would believe what they thought they saw. And Adam saw him as a boy, a child. As such, Adam would underestimate him. And therein lay his chance. Tied like this, unable to free his hands, cunning was the only weapon he had left.
Stop! Don't hit my paw!
Ooh, this man's your paw, that right?
Don't hurt paw!
You and your paw caused a lot of trouble back there, Whitey. Chilled a lot of my men. How old are you, boy?
Jack kept his mouth shut, his scarlet eyes looking fiercely at Adam.
You start answering me, boy, or I'll put a bullet in your tongue. Better yet...
Adam strode over to the children and pulled his gun free. From his place on the ground, Jack watched as the hulking foreman eyed the children. Finally, Adam reached out for the unruly mop atop Francis Frankie's head.
What's wrong, fuckhead? Don't want me to tear your girlfriend's little fucking head off?
Don't!
So, fuckhead?
Titeen.
What's that? What'd you say?
Titeen. I'm 13.
And what's wrong with you? What's wrong with your skin? You see what I done to your daddy up there, and you saw what I did to your playmate. You better start answering, or I'll be doing a damn sight worse to you. Now, what is it? You a mutie?
Not a mutie. Just no son in me. Won't stick.
Jack looked up at Ryan, hanging at the front of the chrome and steel monstrosity. They had even left his Sig Sauer in its hip holster. Such was the contempt they had for the one-eyed warrior now. Jack could understand that. Ryan posed no threat to them any longer. Of course, they didn't know Ryan Carter like he did. Jack had learned, time and again, never to underestimate the man's abilities or the depth of his single-minded determination.
So, what are you doing on my train? We picked you up spying on us, that right?
That goat on train.
Oil? You think we got oil on this here beastie?
Where you hear that?
Man told Pa.
Man told him wrong, then. The only oil we got is in the lamps, and that's from vegetables. You were suckered, boy. So, how come he chilled so many?
How many I chilled?
A family of assassins, that it?
Well, every week.
So my men managed to pick up some hitman's son and stick him in a cage. No wonder your daddy came aboard mad and gunning. You got a name? Your paw?
Daisby. Floyd.
Jack nodded toward Ryan's hanging body.
Abby Jr.
Well, I'm Adam, and I'm gonna be the person who chills you, Junior Thursby. You alone, Junior? You alone, or I gotta hunt every car of my train to find Mama Thursby and the Thursby brothers?
Just us. Pa and me.
You better be telling the truth, Junior, or you'll be joining your little friend face down in a pool of red.
They're gonna be coming for us.
JB stood in the tiny compartment with his back to the curtain door.
And they won't be sparing any bullets now, not after the show me and Ryan put on for them.
I seem to recall an agreement that stealth was to be the order of the day.
We were put in a situation where stealth wasn't going to cut it. But we might still save our asses with it now if we act smart.
What are you thinking?
No train tracks can go on forever. Sooner or later, this thing has to stop, get refueled. We'll hang out, heads down, till then. Might be a better opportunity to free Jack, too.
And what about Ryan?
Burns me up to leave him, but I don't know where he is, or if he's still alive, or even on the train anymore. Sorry to say it, but the odds aren't good.
He's not dead. I'd know if he'd been chilled.
Let's be practical. We all need to keep our feet firmly on the ground right now, Christy.
They have cages, don't they? Ryan could be in one of those.
Those are just for kids. I didn't see any caged adults. I'm just being honest now.
Screw honesty! He's alive! I know it!
Let us not go throwing the baby out with the bathwater here, Christy, my dear. Mayhap Ryan is alive. No one said he's not. But shouting up a storm and getting us detected would be an indubitable way of losing any opportunity of finding him, would it not?
I'm sorry. I'd know, okay? I'd know.
Unless anyone's got a better plan, I say we go into hiding till the train stops.
I hardly think we can take on a whole train of reprobates as we are.
I'll take on the whole lot of them if it saves Ryan.
We all would, but we have to play things smart.